Morning, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Today, a conversation with Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. In the 6 months since he was first appointed as interim commissioner, Davis has overseen a city and a police department deep in turmoil over the death last April of Freddie Gray. I'll talk with Kevin Davis about the tensions between Baltimore police and the communities they're sworn to protect and what he's doing to rebuild public confidence in the city's law enforcement establishment. Then the Hills are alive with the Hippodrome Theater's production of The Sound of Music. The beloved story of the Von Trapp family continues to thrill audiences with its Tony, Grammy, and Academy Award-winning score. Our theater critic Jay Wynn Russick has a review of a brand new production of this timeless classic. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Nathan Sterner has the local news. First, the national headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much to everybody who made a pledge in our year-end pledge drive. We really appreciate the support. I am pleased to welcome back to the show this morning Baltimore City Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. In July, he was appointed interim commissioner to replace Anthony Batts, and in mid-October, he was sworn in as the permanent police commissioner. He heads the eighth largest police department in the country at a time when police misconduct cases in cities like Chicago, New Orleans, and elsewhere have focused attention on the frayed relationship between police and, in particular, communities of color. Here in Baltimore, the trial of Officer William Porter is wrapping up its second week. There are five more officers awaiting trial charged in the death of Freddie Gray last April. A verdict in any one of those trials could spark more violence, and as Commissioner Davis completes his 6 month on the job, the police department faces a number of serious challenges, including a homicide and crime rate that are the worst in decades. So, Commissioner, on that happy note, happy holidays. It's good to see you.
Thanks, Tom. Happy holidays to you. It's always great to be at WYPR.
Well, thanks for coming. We appreciate it. So you've said that a difference between now and last April is that the department is considerably more prepared for any unrest that might happen in terms of training equipment. One of the big complaints that the rank and file had in the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police After Action Report, was the leadership saying, and they complained that essentially the police hands were tied during the unrest. Have you and the mayor talked about that, and do you have plans to overcome those kinds of problems should there be unrest following one of these verdicts?
Well, Tom, the mayor and I have had robust conversations about going forward, and as you probably know, there have been three after-action reports that have assessed our performance back in April and May, and in their own different ways, and they each have a way of saying it, they all address leadership, and if you sort through it all, it was really a lack of clarity. And I think that lack of clarity came from about 47 years of not experiencing a civil disturbance of that magnitude. It really might sound different, but the easy things were training and equipment. So it took a lot of work to get to where we are now in terms of our equipment that police officers are issued in terms of sophisticated incident command system training. But the thing that is most valuable is our experience, and our experience has been our greatest teacher. And from those experiences, you'll get better clarity in leadership. So the troops do just thrive and yearn for direction in moments of crisis, and I'll give them that direction.
And you'll be giving that direction. You're not concerned that there's going to be pressure from you know, the political quarters to do this?
No. I've heard that in certain corners of the city, but I haven't seen that at all. You know, but the mayor, the council, everyone's just so supportive of what we do, and I think a lot of those conversations have been a little embellished and exaggerated over time.
So much of what your challenges comprise now are issues of trust, rebuilding trust in the community, particularly in the African-American community, rebuilding trust between you and the rank and file in the police department, and rebuilding trust or cultivating whatever trust there is with the state's attorney's office. You're in the middle of these trials, yet, of course, you know, in the middle of Officer Porter's trial, there are other trials going on in that same courthouse. There are other cases being prosecuted in which the police department has to work with the state's attorney's office. What's that relationship like in the context of all of these Freddie Gray trials?
Right. Well, with the state's attorney herself, Marilyn and Mosby and I have a very healthy open relationship. And I was at an event with her last night, and some folks were looking at Marilyn and I engaged in conversation. And it was like they were surprised by that. And people shouldn't be surprised by the fact that the police commissioner and the state's attorney have a working relationship, because if we can't work together, then that's not good for this city. But in terms of the rank and file and the community, and you talk about trust, and it's just a matter of being a good listener right now. So if I've done anything internally well so far, I think I've listened to the concerns of cops. And like we talked before the show this morning, you know, I've been doing as much as I can, really unplanned, unannounced in the community, by just getting out of a car and walking around. And I think it surprises people when they see the city's leadership just show up at an unplanned, unstaged event and just talk.
Sure.
So I think Baltimore likes that. They like that one-on-one interaction, and it's something that I can't do enough, both internally and externally.
But when it comes to Marilyn Mosby and your relationship personally with her, I mean, you guys hang out? Do you
meet
each other? But do you talk? I mean, do you, bop over and have a cup of coffee?
I don't do a whole lot of bopping around unless there's a purpose. But you know, she and I have regular meetings with each other, mm-hmm. About cases and about things going on.
And it's possible to sort of, you know, bifurcate what's going on with the Freddie Gray trials from what the other stuff is going on.
It's necessary. So. Mm-hmm. You know, we work together on so many matters. This one particular matter, while it's receiving a ton of attention nationwide, doesn't detract or shouldn't detract from all the other things that we need to accomplish together. And if she and I had, hypothetically, a relationship that was less than stellar, it would impact the relationships between detectives, cops, and her prosecutors.
Yeah, sure.
So it's really important that Marilyn and I maintain this relationship, and it's really easy to do. So we have a great relationship.
Well, one of the places that you've been getting out of the car, walking around, is over by North Avenue and Greenmount Avenue. Our producers, John McCone and Kathleen Cahill, went over to Greenmount and North Avenue and talked to some folks over there. Here's Cephas, who had this to say.
Law enforcement is on trial, not the officers. They got to look at law enforcement the way it is, the pros and cons of it, on the federal, local, and state level, and they need more surveillance of officers on the psychiatry side, because it's not easy carrying a gun.
It's not easy carrying a gun. I think he was trying to choose his words carefully. It seems to me that to restore trust in the African-American community, you're going to need to have people in the community, leaders in the community, people who live in these neighborhoods, telling others that it's okay to trust the police. Seems to me that the police aren't going to be able, after all that's happened, to walk up to folks and say, okay, everything's cool now, we're good, you can trust us. They're going to have to hear from people that they look up to, people they respect. What's your outreach to those leaders, to those, you know, the people shaping the thoughts and opinions in the communities?
Well, unfortunately, Tom, there are some communities in the city and other places in America just have years and years of shared negative experiences with police. And that's something that didn't happen overnight. I think when you talk about trust, the community will only begin to trust us in a different way when the community sees us respect them. So Cephas kind of hit a couple nails right on the head with his remarks. We do have to ensure that the folks that we trust to wear this uniform and to do things in this country that no other profession can do. We can take someone's freedom away and charge them with a crime. That's an awesome responsibility. We can also, with justification, take a life. So we have these 21, 22-year-olds who join our profession. And if I could just remark just for a second on what Cephas said about the backgrounds we need to do on folks who represent us. There's 900,000 or so cops in America. There's 18,000 police departments. We constantly have a conversation about the quality of people that we're having. And it's not a perfect science. So, you know, we're engaged in discussions with the major cities chiefs and International Association of Police Chiefs, our chiefs of police, to ensure that our hiring practices and standards are the very, very best they can be.
Here's another fellow over at Greenmount and North Avenue. This is Bernard.
If they could treat us like men and people, and genuinely, we'd have a more different type of respect for them. But until then, it's basically a survival type of mode because they violent, even in times where violence ain't necessary. So don't expect me to not be defensive if you coming to me trying to hurt me. Everyone is a person, and we are somebody's brother, mother, sister, cousin, and we expect to be treated as such. They wouldn't want their family members treated like that, so why treat us like that? We somebody's family member as well.
Just what you're saying, this is an issue of respect.
It is.
It also, in some people's minds, is an issue of transparency. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, they've just published a database that includes more than 56,000 cases of complaints about police misconduct over a 10-year period, and that was court-ordered. Do you expect that there might be a court order here that would oblige the police department to make that kind of information in Baltimore available to people? And what do you think about that as a good idea or a bad idea?
We can't be transparency is something that we always have to strive to do more and more and more. And one of my first hires when I got here was T.J. Smith. He's the director of our media relations and well known to the Baltimore area. So
good guy.
Great guy. So the things that TJ does on behalf of the police department and the city speak to transparency. There are certain things pursuant to criminal investigations that we can't share, but you know, this is the 21st century. So when folks come to me, my question to them is, why can't we share this information as opposed to why should we share this information? And that's the old way, but why can't we? And when I ask folks that, they have to prove to me that we can't share, and only in the most sensitive criminal cases do we not share information. But, you know,
you would expect that we'd see more
as much as we can
about
do.
The police misconduct
now, there are,
complaints?
Well, there are certainly, the devil's always in the details, Tom. There's certain laws in the state. There's certain personnel laws that exist that prevent us from disclosing some personnel information. I think during this upcoming legislative session, you're going to see some of those laws addressed and possibly amended. But it's important for the community to know that the
What do you think about that? The Police Bill of Rights, which the legislature is intending to take a look. What's your suggestion to them? If this law needs to be tweaked, how would you tweak it?
Well, Maryland chiefs and Maryland sheriffs just put together a set of recommendations that I stand by. They have several recommendations to amend and improve the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. I think that legislation has been around since 1974 or so, and it's largely unchanged. So Maryland chiefs, Maryland sheriffs have proactively taken the lead and sent a letter to the leadership in Annapolis recommending changes. So that's a positive step in the right direction because people want to know that the person responding to their 911 call, the person interacting with their son or daughter, is the type of person that they want in their community. So we can't do enough. And Tom, I always need to say this, the vast, vast majority of police officers in Baltimore and anywhere consistently do the right thing. They really, really do. There's an occasional bad apple or two in every profession. We have criminally charged 3 police officers since I've been the police commissioner. I won't hesitate to do it. Anyone who embarrasses this uniform is someone that's going to receive swift attention from me.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Great to have you with us on this Friday morning. Continuing now our conversation with Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. After spending most of last summer as the interim police commissioner, he was appointed to the permanent post last fall. He's finishing up his 6th month on the job this month. He served as the deputy commissioner for 7 months prior to that after a long career in Prince George's and Anne Arundel County. Commissioner, I want to play for you a more tape of some of the folks over on Greenmount and North Avenue. This is a guy named Mohammed who owns a mini mart over there. He's a business person.
You know, like I say, most of the time when they're around here, it's quiet. It's no problems. When they're not, it's problems. You know, like I say, everybody want to be tough. That's the problem in Baltimore right now. Everybody want to be seen as tough.
Your deployment strategies, have they changed much since you took over from Commissioner Batts?
Significantly. They've changed. Back in January of this year, the police department abandoned its patrol posts and went to a larger sector concept. It's like going from man-to-man defense to zone defense, if I could use a football analogy. Mm-hmm. This past Monday, we went back to patrol posts. You know, one of the first things that I heard from the rank and file when I took over was, you know, please, please give us back our patrol posts. It defines their identity. And when the patrol posts were taken from the cops, it's like taking the number off the back of your jersey.
And that means that they're given a specific piece of real estate.
Absolutely.
And you
own it. You own it. You know it. You're responsible for calls for service there. You're responsible for getting to know people there. There may be times where you're pulled out of that post for an emergency elsewhere. But all things being equal, you should be in that post. And then supervisors and commanders can go to that patrol officer and hold him or her accountable for the activities, good, bad, or indifferent, that occur in the post. And it was really something that that impacted our crime fight, to tell you the truth. And most recently, I've done a couple other things in terms of patrol or staffing strategies and investigative strategies. I centralized all of the detectives on the agency that investigate non-fatal shootings. They're now at headquarters. They're working more closely with each other and with homicide. We're in the third or fourth week of all sworn officers who have administrative jobs on the agency several nights a week. They're out working at night in uniform, on foot, or in patrol cars, and that seems to certainly afford us that presence, because communities like to see the police, because it assures them. So a big part of this profession is being seen in our communities, and it just makes people feel like we're paying attention to their
problems. And you're training cadets about how to interact with citizens.
Yeah, so we're for the first department to develop an academic curriculum called Community Foot Patrol. So we assume, wrongly so, that police officers know what it means when we tell them to get out of their car and walk a beat or walk a post. 99% of that is communicating with people when you're out on foot. So today's young cops are smarter than ever. They're IT savvy. They're really unique in so many ways. But one of the challenges we have with young people in this profession and probably others is their communication skills. So we have to teach better communication skills. And police academies traditionally teach recruits how to interact with victims and witnesses and suspects and reporting people. But this other group over here called everybody else. So how do you look someone in the eye when you're walking down a sidewalk and say good morning? And you know, how long have you lived in Baltimore? And where did you go to high school? And you know, how was your day going? So we're teaching those skills.
But speaking of the young cops, let's also talk for a minute about the old cops. I'm hearing that there's an unusually high number of people retiring from the force, particularly this month, December. We're going to lose a lot of experienced people. What can you tell us about that?
Well, every December, you'll see retirements and people go at the end of the year. We spiked in retirements, resignations back in midsummer. They've leveled off since then. We'll have a newly eligible batch of police officers in Baltimore eligible to retire in 2016. We formed a recruiting and retention committee to address that. Often it's just the little things that'll keep people around. So we're doing all we can to keep experience here. And
you're not concerned that there's going to be this big exodus of experience?
No, I'm not concerned. It's something we're taking seriously, and we're looking for strategies to keep people around. I just sent over 584 letters to Baltimore police officers who have resigned or retired in good standing since 2010. I sent them a letter about 2 weeks ago telling them or asking them to consider coming back and be part of this comeback in the city and the police department. And we gave them a path to come back. And we've gotten a number of inquiries from retirees who want to come back and be part of something special.
So recruitment is a challenge then, not only at the cadet level,
challenge. It's a challenge for the profession. So, you know, Chuck Ramsey was just on a national news talking about how difficult it is right now recruiting because the profession is under a microscope right now. But we have to do all we can to remind people of the service component of being a police officer. And it takes creativity and it takes work, but it's something we have to do.
Let's talk about the homicide rate. And it's not that it hasn't been talked about a lot before, but do you have any clearer notion to explain why the spike has happened in these last 6 to 8 months? Not just here, but New Orleans, Atlanta, Milwaukee, St. Louis. We've talked to a number of people, you know, post riot in April, who had their theories, much of it related to the actual unrest itself, others debunking those theories. What's your theory? What's your explanation to folks as to why there's so many more violent crimes?
I think it's too early to carve any explanation into stone. I also think it's too early to debunk any explanation. So locally, you know, why is it that Washington, D.C. and Prince George's County are both up in murder? So what's happening? So riots didn't happen there. Unrest didn't happen there. So it's more than just that. But I think if you just look specifically in Baltimore, and 2014 was the second best year in homicides the city has experienced since before 1972. We got the same cops, the same detectives, the same commanders, the same crime fighting strategies. So what has changed? And it's probably about 12 different things that have changed. The unrest and post-unrest violence is something you can't ignore. It's a fact. It did surge after.
And a lot of people think the police have been laying back.
Yeah. Well, I look at several things to measure that. And I tell people this, obviously unscientifically, that the city had PTSD after the unrest. We were knocked back on our heels, you know, and we didn't know how to wrap our arms around what just happened to us in such a short amount of time. So the cops had anxiety. The cops had anxiety about the criminal charges against their peers. The cops had anxiety about 168 of their peers going to the hospital during the unrest. Most police officers here are young, just like elsewhere. So, you know, people started questioning
their
role.
Six trials. You know, these trials will go on, you know, well through the spring.
Next year.
Will that anxiety continue? I mean,
it's important for us to get this
first
one right.
And if that anxiety is manifested by police laying back and being tentative, you know, are we just in for more of the same?
Well, I think you look at certain things to measure how police officers, the level of productivity. And one of the things that you look at are the number of gun arrests and gun seizures, because guns just don't fall out of the heavens, right? You have to stop people, you have to stop people in vehicles, and you have to do police work to recover firearms. So since July the 8th, since I took over, our firearm seizures and arrests are up over 25%. That's a significant increase in gun seizures. And in any other year, and I do believe 2015 will prove to be an anomaly, but any other year, Tom, when you have an increase in gun seizures like that, it would coincide with a drop and violence. People are choosing to carry guns nowadays. Maryland, you know, for the strict gun laws that Maryland touts, it is still a misdemeanor offense to wear, carry, or transport an illegal firearm in this state. It needs to be a felony, and the legislators need to take it very, very seriously. That's been brought up before in Maryland. It's never made its way out of the Judiciary Committee. It's a felony to carry an illegal gun in D.C., and they've enjoyed some significant crime reductions over the last 15 years. It needs to be a felony in Maryland now. More bad guys are making a decision to carry a gun as opposed to leaving it at home, and there needs to be a consequence to that. It can't just be probation before judgment and a slap on the wrist.
Police Commissioner Kevin Davis is my guest on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. Let's also talk about the spike in property crimes and robberies and assaults, many of which are being attributed to kids. These are young offenders, you know, 12, 15, 17 years old. And we're hearing from people in places like Station North and Bolton Hill and Mount Vernon, Mount Washington. You know, houses are getting broken into. Have you met with Sam Abed, the head of Juvenile Services, Department of Juvenile Services in the state of Maryland? Do you have a relationship with him? And is there any light that he can shed on this kind of stuff?
I don't know if he can shed any specific light beyond statistics. We had a spree of cat burglaries, homes that were being broken into, residential homes being broken into while people were inside at night. And probably 20-plus burglaries up at the northern end of the city. Well, we finally closed that. It was three people, Tom, three. And one of the three people was a juvenile, and it was the eighth time he has been arrested by Baltimore police for a burglary. So, you know, when you talk about juvenile criminal justice, it's important to look at how property crimes impact communities and neighborhoods, and there has to be a bigger consequence for those type of crimes. We're doing the best we can to improve our property crime strategy. We can be both that violent crime fighting organization and pay attention more to property crimes. I always say that people will consider where they live or consider putting a for sale sign in front of their house when their home is broken into, when their car is stolen or broken into, or when it takes the cops too long to get to their 911 call. So I realize that all those things are spoken about routinely around the kitchen table. They're not always on the 6 o'clock news, but you know, I'm really aware of what people talk about in communities, and property crimes is the number one thing.
Are you confident that the hole in the dike has been plugged at this point?
Well, I'd like to get...
You've got a repeat offender, evidently.
Repeat offenders are a problem in America, you know, and they're not only violent repeat offenders, but repeat thieves and repeat burglars.
Like with the homicide rate, is there any particular explanation? Anything strike you as a reason that there's more of that now than there was 6 months ago?
Yeah, I think we'll get to a point down the road where we'll be able to look back more academically at what happened in 2015. And Baltimore is not the only place that's going to be doing that. I've convened with major city chiefs across this country on several occasions since this summer, and we all share stories, and we all they're all similar. They're strikingly similar. It's not just that the violence is up, it's that the property crime is up. So we have to change our strategies, and you know, maybe 2015 is that year, hopefully it is that year, that policing in America changed. We're in the midst of a sea change right now, and we'll get it right because we have to get it right. We're the greatest country in the world, and you know, we're just in the at a unique time in our country's history with law enforcement, and we'll get it right.
Yeah, let's talk. Let's listen to another clip from a woman over at Greenmount and North Avenue. This woman named LaShawn.
I feel like they should be trained, retrained, and trained again if they have to be, to use non-lethal force instead of shooting to kill. Stop shooting in the chest, in the head, try the legs, the arms, something just to stop a person in their tracks, but not to kill them. They have tasers, right? What's wrong with using the tasers? Stop, you know, to stop a person.
It all seems so simple. You know, you're in the middle of a situation, you just aim down instead of aim up. Again, this goes to trust. But is there training like that in place, you know, when there is a violent confrontation? Do you actually talk to the officers and say, don't aim here, aim there?
It's not a matter of where you aim. You know, this isn't a television show or a movie. Police-involved shootings in Baltimore are down from where they have been in the past, but we have pretty sophisticated de-escalation training now. The bulk of our patrol officers are issued tasers. So all the less lethal tools that we can get our hands on to prevent that deadly force scenario are things that we're doing, and all the training that we can get our hands on. And our de-escalation training in Baltimore, there's no better de-escalation training in the country. We're doing it. I think the introduction of body-worn cameras in the city is going to go a long, long way. It's one of those unique moments where the community looks at body-worn cameras and said, finally, you know, people will see how the cops treat us. And the cops say, finally, people will see how tough our job is. Mm-hmm. So I don't care the
and
reason.
That's on schedule? I mean, you're scheduled to make a decision about which kind and what to do,
right.
You know,
so
early next year?
We have three different types. The pilot ends December the 18th, which is fastly, you know, quickly approaching. And then we'll take a look at all the feedback we've received from our police officers, and then we'll choose a product and go forward. But I'm really looking forward to this. It's new in law enforcement. So the agencies across America that have body-worn cameras are figuring out policies and procedures, and the devil's always in the details. But I know, I really, really know that body-worn cameras will make our relationship with the community better. We're already getting that feedback from cops.
And speaking of de-escalation, at your confirmation hearing, there were some protests by some kids and some others involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. They wanted to talk to you, and one of the things they wanted to talk to you about was this interaction during protests between the police and demonstrators. Things have calmed down a little bit since then. Have you had a chance to sit down with them, talk to them, and you said you've done a lot of listening. Have you been able to listen specifically to what their concerns are?
I've spoken to several of the grassroots protest organizers, and it's I won't shy away from any of those conversations. There, a lot of them are in high school, some in college, some just out of college. They're really thoughtful civic activists, and they want to change how government works in our country. So they're not, their issues aren't necessarily specific to the police. They certainly include the police, but they've got a lot of things that are on their minds, and they're bright people that'll make our country better. But you know, my concentration now, especially during these trials, is in the communities like North Penn. So as often as I can get out of a car and interact with people who I won't probably see on Calvert Street engaged in a protest, I need to make sure that I'm reaching out to them as well. And since I've been a police commissioner, we've made minimal arrests during protests. We made two during two motions hearings. And the night of my confirmation hearing, we made, I think, 16 arrests at 4 o'clock in the morning because I wasn't going to let the business of the city get disrupted. And we have a protest today now, and we had two yesterday. We're going to have one tonight, and we're there to keep the peace. We're not there to make arrests whatsoever.
No, it's a busy job, and we appreciate you being here this morning and talking about it. Plenty more to talk about. We look forward to having you on again and continuing this conversation.
Anytime, Tom.
Thanks so much, Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. Coming up a little later on the show, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will stop in for a conversation about a classic musical, The Sound of Music.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, you're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. The Sound of Music is at the Hippodrome Theater. It's there through the weekend. And to tell us her thoughts on this iconic classic, our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick. Judy, how you doing?
Good morning. Doing fine.
So The Sound of Music, I mean, of all the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, perhaps of all musicals in the world, it's, you know, the best known thing. I mean, the movie, people have do sing-along things with the movie.
Oh, yes.
Follow the Bouncing Ball. There was that Carrie Underwood thing on television, a million productions of it on Broadway. There's a new one right here in Baltimore this weekend at the Hippodrome. Any new insights into this timeless classic, as we say?
Well, Tom, this might not be a brand new insight, but it's one that struck me much more strongly than in any other production I've seen. And I know this is going to sound simplistic considering the title, but this is a show about the power of music. Music, I mean, singing when she shouldn't, is one of the things that gets Maria sent away from the abbey where she's preparing to be a nun. And music is what she uses to create a bond with Captain Von Trapp's children when she becomes their governess. And music is eventually what saves the Von Trapp family from the Nazis. So this has always been an underlying theme, but it really comes through in this splendid production, thanks to really smart direction by Jack O'Brien and musical direction by Jay Alger, who leads a very strong orchestra.
Anything new and different in terms of casting? I mean, you know, the Maria role, the Julie Andrews role, the Carrie Underwood role, whatever you want, whatever generation you are and you, which one you want to pick. It's always been a vehicle for a star. So may I say, how do you solve a problem like casting Maria?
Such a good question. Well, and of course, it was originally Mary Martin. It was definitely a star vehicle for her. Even though this is a national tour that has not announced any Broadway plans, it does have a veteran Broadway director and choreographer and design team and most of the cast. But in this case, Jack O'Brien deliberately chose to cast an unknown instead of a star as Maria. He wanted a newcomer. And he found this young woman named Kirsten Anderson, who is a student at Pace University. This is her professional debut. And she brings this bristling enthusiasm to Maria. My theory is that just like everything is new to Maria, everything is also new to Kirsten Anderson. It's, theatre verite.
And that could be great. I mean, Maria is a pretty naive young girl, you know, finding her way in the world, falling in love and all that. I mean, so that's probably, you know, that's good.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
Typecasting.
Oh, it works perfectly.
Besides, Boy George wasn't available. Right?
So. But she's this irrepressible singer, and she's irrepressible about just about everything. Plus, there is romantic chemistry with Captain Von Trapp, who's played by a Tony Award winner named Ben Davis. They're closer in age than usual. And Kirsten Anderson is young enough to be believable as a friend, a true friend to the oldest Von Trapp child, who, as you may remember, is 16. I brought a selection of the first time she sings My Favorite Things, and I think you can really hear that bristling enthusiasm.
When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel.
All right, newcomer Kirsten Anderson as Maria. That's My Favorite Things, of course, from The Sound of Music. It's at the Hippodrome through this weekend. So Maria teaches that song to the kids, the Von Trapp children. The child actors are usually a large part of this show appeal because there's so many of them. Is that true in this particular production?
Absolutely, especially the littlest Von Trapp. And there's some very cute staging to go along with it. When the kids are frightened by a thunderstorm and Maria calms them by, guess what, singing, unlike the movie, the song they sing is The Lonely Goat Herd, and one of the little girls pretends to be a goat. She wears a pair of bedroom slippers as the goat's ears. This production, Tom, goes back to the original 1959 Broadway libretto, so People who know the movie back and forth and have gone to those sing-alongs will notice a few differences, such as a couple of songs that were dropped from the 1965 movie. But getting back to those adorable kids, the first song she teaches them is also very charming.
A female deer, bay, a drop of golden sun. Me, I name, I call myself, fa, I've a long way to run.
All right, that's the cast of a new touring production of The Sound of Music at the Hippodrome. Certainly sounds adorable. I'm weeping already, but there's more than just adorableness to this musical. I mean, there's a dark side of this plot. How do they treat that?
Oh, there's definitely a dark side. I mean, The Sound of Music is a story about an Austrian family evading the Nazis. But most of the productions I've seen, and especially the movie, sugarcoat this story. I should say, Oscar Hammerstein, this is unusual, he didn't write the script for this show. Howard Lindsay and Russell Crouse were already set to do that when Rodgers and Hammerstein became involved. And I do wonder how it might have differed if Hammerstein had written the script. But this production doesn't shy away from the darkness, particularly at that climactic concert when the Von Trapp family is singing near the end of the show. Ben Davis's voice actually breaks when Captain Von Trapp is singing Edelweiss, the last song Oscar Hammerstein wrote, by the way. When he's singing that song, he turns and he faces this huge backdrop of Nazi banners, and it's a moving moment.
Yeah, well, of course, anytime you sing Edelweiss, anytime anybody, my voice cracks anytime I sing Edelweiss, and it's usually two or three times a day. Now, Sound of Music is, of course, actually based on a true story.
Yes.
This is a real family, and one of the Von Trapp children lived in Baltimore. I remember years ago, her daughter or her niece or something gave her tickets to the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. We were doing a big German piece. It was Handel's Messiah.
Oh, wow.
And she came to the concert, and I met her. She was a lovely person. I guess she's passed away now.
Yes, she died in 2010. She was 97, but she lived here more than 50 years. Agatha Von Trapp. She and another lady started a kindergarten and ran that. She had been living with her family in Vermont, where they have a ski resort, which I have been to. And I also had an experience with her. I interviewed her for The Sun in 1999 when a different revival of The Sound of Music was at the Lyric. She actually wrote her autobiography a few years later, and she would always point out the differences between the true story and the show. The children were much older when they escaped. She was actually 25, I think. They didn't climb any mountains. Sorry to have to tell you this, but they took the train. And her father was not the stern taskmaster he is in the show. That was one thing that really always bothered her. And he must not have opposed their singing in public, because the family was doing that in Europe a few years before they escaped from the Nazis. I should say she did, as I understand it, eventually come to accept the musical.
Okay, so she came, this is Agatha Von Trapp, came to terms with the musical. How about you? Did you come to terms with this latest production?
Oh, more than that, Tom. This is the best production of The Sound of Music I've seen. I mean, the Carrie Underwood TV version was very disappointing. I saw another disappointing version at the Lyric in the early 1990s with Marie Osmond and Keir Dulay. I know this will sound like sacrilege, but I'm not a big fan of the movie. This production, however, gets just about everything right.
Come on!
All right, The Sound of Music. It's at the Hippodrome Theater. Our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, looks like you're giving it two thumbs up, huh?
Absolutely.
All right, it's there at the Hippodrome Theater until Sunday. We've got information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's all for us today. Nathan Sterner is Maryland Morning's co-host, director, and engineer. Rob Sivak, Jonna McCone, Kathleen Cahill produced the broadcast with assistance from Scott Seiss. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville provides our Java Jolt. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. And thanks to Chris Kennedy at Clean Cuts Music for providing great theme music for Maryland Morning since 2006. On Monday morning, you'll hear the debut of our new theme music by another of the Clean Cuts gang, Austin Coughlin. Also coming up on Monday, a look at a new Able Foundation report on the state of the Chesapeake Bay and some fashion gift ideas from our dress-up doyenne, Zoe Washington Chef. We'll see you Monday morning right here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.